Even though we're not officially in the Levinson tent, we want to thank the Levinsons for opening up their homes to us. We'd be there if we could, but the wind and circumstances are preventing us from being there. Thank you so much to Emma and Neely for making this happen, and to everyone here for coming together to learn from near and from far. We're making our way through Orchot Tzadikim. You know, we covered the two chapters last week, the one and two on Anava and Gaiva, and now we're moving on a little bit to something that's related, Busha and Azus. And we're going to try and translate those in a second. But again, just for so we remember our plan and our goal here, we're looking at two chapters because Orchot Tzadikim, for the most part, looks at extremes. It looks at, you know, one side of a meter and the other side. And oftentimes, just by the way, the first of those pair chapters are going to be longer because the author kind of covers a lot of the details in the first chapter. The second one is just, you know, detailing a few of the others. And so we've got Busha and Azus, and Busha is a much longer chapter than Azus. Azus is only like 7 paragraphs or so. And the past couple of weeks, we've had a lot to cover. There's a lot less on this than we've had, and so I'm hoping that that'll help make things a little bit more cohesive and not feel like we're jumping around quite as much. Mitzvah Hashem. And so let's jump in. We're talking about Busha and we're talking about Azus. Azus is actually very hard to translate. Maybe we know that this concept of being Oz, Oz technically means strength, but someone who's an Oz, who's got Azus, I think the official translation is impotence, but that doesn't mean anything to any of us. But we could say chutzpah. Azus is chutzpah, someone who's willing to go out. Right, so we've got a lot of instances. That basically, it's chutzpah. That's really, I think, the best way to translate it. I checked Rabbi Leibowitz, this is his favorite sefer, and he translates it as chutzpah also, so that's good enough for me. And so Busha, what does Busha mean? You know, we know the word Busha, and when we're trying to understand what it means, there are a lot of different ways we could look at it. But even if we translate it, we're not necessarily going to be able to appreciate what it is. One of the things that, you know, in talking about, you know, about the Shirim we're preparing for, one of the things I'd like to try and do is try and figure out, all right, you know, Midos are not something that Jews have an exclusive right on. You know, do psychologists talk about this? Are there TED Talks out there that, you know, that address these issues? And so if you want to talk about Busha, you want to talk about Azus, maybe you want Azus in a good way sometimes might be courage. And so if you want to talk about Busha, you want to talk about courage, you want to talk about chutzpah, you got to go, there's like one address these days. She's somewhat of a pop psychologist, but doctor, although she's very rarely referred to as doctor, but a wonderful Texan woman named Brené Brown. And Brené Brown is super famous. She's got like 3 TED Talks with like millions of views. She has a Netflix special. And I didn't know that Netflix made specials for people who weren't comedians. Like, she's not like telling jokes. She's like talking about like real things. And yet Netflix thought it was worthy of having a whole special, Biskusa. And so she's a big deal. And, you know, we checked with some of our local experts, and she's not just like, you know, just pop psychology. A lot of what she says, you know, does track in the conventional psychological clinical world. And so Brené Brown talks about shame a lot. And she says that shame and guilt are two very similar experiences. And if we're going to translate Busha, likely shame or guilt might fit into that category. Except the way she translates, or the way she understands guilt and shame, I think is not consistent with the way Yiddishkeit and the way our Sefer is understanding it. What she says, and this is important to know just colloquially, that guilt and shame are very different because guilt is I did something bad. Okay, I messed up. I did a bad thing. I did something bad. That's guilt. Shame, in stark contrast, unfortunately, is not I did something bad, but that I am bad. Shame is when you put an external title on yourself. And that's something that we definitely want to avoid. And from a psychological level, it's not healthy in the slightest. But if we were to translate Busha as either shame or guilt in that fashion, we wouldn't really be understanding it properly. And so if that's the case, what does it mean? Well, first, let's just appreciate why we don't think that it means what it is. I haven't shared a source sheet. Oh my gosh. Okay, I so apologize. All right, we need a source sheet. Give me 1 second. I don't know why, like, okay. So we're going to share a source sheet just momentarily. All right, so we have our source sheets organized. And in the first source, we have a Gemara Masechet Yevamot. And Yevamot, in general, is talking about, you know, Jewish marriage and Jewish peoplehood, and there's a whole discussion about Geirus. And now on Daf Ayin Tes Amud Aleph 79a, it tells us, how do you identify a Jew? If you're walking down the street, how do you figure out if someone's Jewish or not Jewish? It's not the way that they're dressed. It's not the way they walk. It's not, you know, a baseball cap hiding a very obvious keep at a Yankee game. In fact, it is three character traits. What are those three character traits? Shlosha simanim yesh ba'umazu. There are three character traits that belong to Jewish people. Harachmanim, v'habayshanim, v'gomlek asadim. Jewish people are merciful. They are what we might say bashful or shamed face. And they do chesed. Beautiful. That's how you know if someone's Jewish or not. And then we have psukim to prove all of them. But if I'm looking at this list, you know, merciful, beautiful. Someone does chesed, awesome. Someone who can feel busha, bashanim, if busha is translated as shame or guilt, then that doesn't seem to really fit so well. You know, Brené Brown's telling me that that busha is that I did something wrong, or that I am bad, chas v'shalom. Neither one of those seem to really fit in with a Jewish understanding, the Jewish approach to busha. And so what is busha? It can't be a bad thing. Ain't ha baishan lamed, exactly. Right. So we don't, usually we'll start out with the bad mita and then talk about the good mita. Busha, you know, gaiva was the first one, anava was the second mita. Gaiva is bad, anava is good. So we're starting out with busha, that's the third chapter, and the fourth chapter is azus, which would imply that busha is bad and azus is good, except we know that there are instances in which busha is a good thing. So part of that is just the general approach about midos, that it's always a balancing act, and sometimes this mida is good and sometimes it's bad. This doesn't seem to be bad. Busha is not a bad mida per se that we're trying to avoid, like that of gaiva. And so we know that if I want to be identified as a Jew, I'm supposed to have busha. If I want to learn Torah, ein habayshan lamed, I'm never going to learn anything if I am bashful, if I have busha. So what is busha? Baruch Hashem, the Orchus Tzadikim tells us right in the very beginning, in the first paragraph. And so that's our second source, tells us, habusha amru chachamim, haseichel hu habusha, v'habusha hu haseichel. Seichel, intelligence, you know, and thought, is synonymous with busha. Ki al ha'adam v'chav ne'amar v'yihu shnehim aramim ha'adam v'ishto v'lo yusbo shashu. Beginning of time, before Chet Eitz Hadas, Adam and Chav are running around the garden, they're entirely naked, they didn't seem to care, they had no busha, they had no shame. Now, is that a good thing? Is it not a good thing? It would seem that what we're about to find out is that lo hayud yodim hatsnius lahavkin ben tovu ben ra. They didn't appreciate that there's a difference between good and bad. They didn't appreciate that there was this idea of shame, of doing wrong. Ula'akar sha'akum eitz hadas, all of a sudden, once they've eaten from the tree of knowledge, now they're feeling busha. And that's this idea that comes up. It's alluded to in Masechta Shabbos on Ayin Zayin Amud Beis, but it comes up a lot in a lot of places that our words of to get dressed. You know how do you say get dressed? It's easy. It's also on the page. You say levush. Levush means clothing, but levush also, if you vowelize differently, can mean labush. You know, too embarrassed, to feel shame, to be sensitive. Someone who wears clothing is someone who is able to feel shame. Someone who runs around naked, someone who runs around without clothing on, probably doesn't feel any embarrassment. What the Orchos Tzadikim points out at the bottom of our page in the fourth paragraph is that you never see busha with people who are unintelligent. The people who are unintelligent aren't feeling any busha, but people with great intelligence, those are the ones who are most cautious, who are most prone to feeling busha. And so Yiddishkeit seems to think that intelligence and busha are closer related, that I'm only going to feel what we'll call shame, even though it's not Brené Brown's shame. I'm only going to feel shame if I have some level of intelligence, some level of understanding, maybe even some level of self-worth. People, you know, someone who might drink a lot, someone who gets drunk, they're not going to feel shame. You know, they're going to lower their inhibitions. Effectively, what's happening when you get drunk? You lose all sense of intelligence. And so, yeah, of course, you'll run around, you'll do funny and silly things. And if you're at a wedding and Nebuchadnezzar, you feel the need to drink at a wedding instead of just being happy for your friend, it might go well, but in general. I'm very anti-drinking at weddings. So to take the edge off, that's a schmooze for another time and probably for another group of people. But this idea that I'm going to feel shame if I have a level of intelligence, what ultimately it seems to be suggesting is that I need to know who I am. I need to have some level of self-knowledge, self-worth, self-respect in order to feel shame. And so to some extent, building on what we talked about with Gaiva and Anava, that Gaiva is coming from a lack of self-worth and Anava is coming from a fullness of self, maybe this is sort of leads into the next stage of that. But it goes a little bit further. Because there's a concept in psychology of cognitive dissonance. And cognitive dissonance is as follows. I'm getting a couple nods. Maybe someone studied psychology. This is like very basic level, like bachelor's psychology, but if you never learned it, you never learned it. Cognitive dissonance, you can translate the words. Cognitive is, in our brains, and dissonance means there's a disconnect. Cognitive dissonance is when I believe in X, but I'm not necessarily doing that. I'm not performing consistent with my beliefs. There's a dissonance between my cognition, my thoughts, and what I'm actually performing, what I'm actually doing. So on a basic level, let's say, cognitively, I should be eating healthy, but I'm not eating healthy. There's a dissonance in my actions, and I'm going to experience cognitive dissonance at some point where, I might think and I might believe that I'm a healthy eater, but I don't eat right. At a certain point in time, I'm going to feel uncomfortable because I know that I don't fit, that there's a mismatch in my thoughts and in my actions. And so we have one of two options. Dr. Leon Festinger, in like the 50s, he talked about this. I think he coined the term. And he usually said that basically you have two options. Option number one, very simply, I should start eating healthy. I should start doing the right thing. My actions should align with my cognition. Much more likely, though, than aligning my actions is that my actions will dictate my thoughts. That's option number two. I'll just change to what I believe. I used to believe in eating healthy, but that's too hard, that's too annoying, I'm in college, and the food that's available is not necessarily going to be healthy, and so I'm just going to stop eating healthy. Now, in the larger world, maybe that works, maybe that's okay. As far as we're concerned, if we've got a commitment to Torah, to mitzvos, to Dvar Hashem, then the latter is not really an option. We're not going to sacrifice our beliefs just because it's not easy. Cognitive dissonance is going to suggest that. It's going to sort of push us in that direction. And part of the goal of learning Musar is to make sure that doesn't take place, that I can align, that I don't experience any dissonance between my actions and my cognition. And so what we're going to suggest, as we could say, a definition for busha, and what we'll call colloquially shame, is when there's an inconsistency between who I am and who I want to be, or who I think I could or should be. If I think that I could or should be, we'll just say simply an A student, and I'm only a B+ student, then there's a level of busha there. There's a level of embarrassment. Report cards come in, and I didn't get the grade I thought I should have gotten. Not to say the grade I deserved. That's a whole separate spiel, and teachers and college harder than we anticipated. But when I know that I'm an A student, but I didn't try hard enough, I didn't put the requisite effort in this year, that is a very serious level of busha, because I am not where I'm supposed to be. And you see this, Maharal describes it. I learned it from Rabbi David Beshefkin, and Rabbi Meir Singh Lestrom reminded me of it. When Moshe Rabbeinu at Chayta Egel is delaying, he's taking too long on top of the mountain. What does the Pasuk tell us? That Bnei Yisrael is seeing, Vayar ki boshesh Moshe. Moshe was boshesh. I mean, Moshe wasn't hiding. He wasn't embarrassed. Moshe was inconsistent. He told them, I'm going to be down at noon on the 40th day, and he wasn't there. That's busha. That's boshesh Moshe. He was inconsistent in that sense. And when we feel inconsistency, when we feel that cognitive dissonance, then we're experiencing busha. Now, I'll display this in the way that I experienced it most prominently when I was in yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael with Rabina. We've just talked about how Rabina is a very active Rebbe, always looking out for you, always looking to make sure that you can be the best version of yourself. Not everyone should or can go to Netiv Aryeh. It's a very intense kind of Musar experience. In particular, the following example. This mamish happened when I was in yeshiva. There were two boys who went out drinking one night. Now, yeshiva rules say you're not allowed to drink. But also, I think just like, basic understanding of how things operate, boys go to Nativ know that they're not supposed to go out drinking at night. Not just because the rules say, because it's not a good idea. But nonetheless, they went out, they went drinking, and so the next morning, Rabbeinu gets up in front of the whole yeshiva and says, you know, these two boys, we'll call them Reuben and Shimon, Shmarel and Beryl. Shmarel and Beryl, they went out last night, and they were drinking. And we're all like, this is awesome. This is so fun. The rabbi is embarrassing them. And, you know, when you're like, you know, you're like a new Shana Aleph boy, it's like fun to watch someone, you know, get embarrassed that it's being announced that he went out drinking last night. But as like I matured a little bit, I remember asking someone who had been around for a while, like, why is this allowed? Like, why is Rabbeinu allowed to get up and embarrass people like this? And the guy's like, what do you mean? Why do you think he was embarrassing them? Like, well, I wouldn't want someone announcing that about me. Well, he's like, have you gone out drinking? I'm like, no, I'm not supposed to go out drinking. So he's like, okay, so then what do you have to worry about? If Rabbeinu announced that Ari Zucker stayed 20 minutes late after Night Seder last night, would you be embarrassed? I was like, maybe a little bit, but like, no, not really. And he said, if he announced that Ari Zucker called his mom yesterday, would you be embarrassed? I said, no. If he announced that Ari Zucker went out drinking last night when he wasn't supposed to, would you be embarrassed? I said, yes, for sure. And he said, so maybe if Rabbeinu announcing something that you don't mind people knowing, announcing that you're doing the right thing is not going to be a problem. Maybe what he was doing was actually something that I'm told is in the Rambam. I looked through the Rambam, I couldn't find it, but okay, I'm going to trust that it in fact is there. What Rabbeinu is doing, this is a unique, intense educational method that most people cannot and should not use. You have to be Rabbeinu to do it, and it doesn't even always... you have to be Rabbeinu to try it out. But basically all he was doing was saying, oh, if this is something you're doing, if this is an action that you're performing right now, you must think it's a good idea. You must think there's no issue with it. And so if you don't see a problem with it, I'll tell everyone. But if we can live our lives they're consistent, that they're pure, that they're honest, that everything I do, no matter what, is good, then yeah, tell anyone anything that goes on. There was a period of time in my life where I didn't want people looking at my cell phone. You know, they didn't know who I was texting and who knows what's going on. And I don't know if you've experienced this, but you know, people feel very, very protective of their phones. At this point in time in my life, I don't care if anyone looks at my phone. There's nothing on my phone that people can't know about. And so there's no shame there because my phone, Baruch Hashem, is totally consistent with who I am. If you know me, you'll be able to figure out what's on my phone. And so anytime there's a disconnect between who I should be, who I want to be, and who I really am, I'll feel a level of busha. And that's the definition we're going to use as we continue. So far, so good? All right. So there's a Gemara in Bava Kamma on page 2. And this maybe you've heard before, maybe not. This is an important halakha. You have two different kinds of people who take money. One person is what we call a ganav. A ganav is a thief. Thieves walk up to you outside a stern, grab your purse, and run away. All right, we know thieves. Maybe thieves, if they're really involved, they'll have a knife, or they'll have a gun, but they will confront the person and take their money. Now, and then you have that's a ganav. You also have a gazlan. A gazlan is a different individual. He's also taking money, or she. Women allowed to steal money also. And the gazlan is not going to confront you. The gazlan's never going to see you. You're not going to know. What's going to happen is you're going to come home one day, and you'll see that your door was kicked in, and all the valuables in your home have been taken out. Now, growing up, we didn't have a lock on my door, because my mom's like, we don't have any valuables. Like, what are they going to take? And it takes like some sfarim off the wall, take our like moderately, not so impressively sized TV. Like, okay, let them have it. But most people, they have valuables, they don't want them taken, and they come home and they're shocked that their things have been taken. And that is a gazlan, a robber. Now, what's the big difference between a thief and a robber? Well, in the Torah, if you are a thief, the punishment is not as bad as being a robber. If you're a thief and you're caught, and maybe you'll have to pay double, there's a whole situation, that's basically half of Bava Kamma. But if you're a robber, you might not just have to pay two, you might have to pay four or five times how much you stole. And so Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is with his students, I guess they're like having lunch, it's asked the rabbi, and they say, Rebbe, how come a robber, a gazlan, gets a much more... I've got this backwards. How come the thief? No, hold on. All right, I might have my term is backwards. But how come the person who approaches me and steals from me is punished differently than the person who steals from my house? Why is the person stealing from my house so much worse? Why does he get the quadruple or quintuple payment for his theft? And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai basically explained that if someone is stealing from you, then they are confronting you, and they're willing for you to look you in the eye and say, "I am a thief." But someone who's robbing you, someone who's sneaking into your house and taking your possessions, they're afraid of you. They're not willing to let other people see that that they're doing the wrong thing, that they're evil, that they're wicked. And so when it comes to punishment, if we catch someone like that, they're so much worse. Why? Because they're insulting a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Now, because they're the only person or entity that knows that they're stealing is God, but they don't seem to mind that. They're afraid of people, but they're not afraid of God. You need a much bigger punishment. That's a big, big problem. I grew up in Livingston, New Jersey, in suburban Torah. We had a saintly rabbi, but like when you're growing up, like how much time do you spend paying attention to the rabbi's drasha? And so Rabbi Mordechai Feuerstein, he's a tremendous Talmud Chacham. He was a close student of Rav Soloveitchik. His family are big, big tzaddikim. And I didn't pay attention to his drashos so much. There are two drashos that he gave in my early years that I still remember. One about Henry Ford that we're not going to talk about tonight. And one where he pointed out, it must have been in and around Yom Kippur, where he said that when someone sins, they're really doing two things. It's not just one. One piece of it is that you messed up. You spoke Lashon Hara. You ate the wrong food. You woke up late. Whatever the situation. But there's another piece of our sin that's actually in some ways much, much worse. Because the second element of someone performing a chait is that they're almost saying, God is not here right now. No, God's not in the room. It's okay for me to speak Lashon Hara. It's okay for me to do this bad action because I don't really believe that God's watching in the moment. And that is so much worse than the first piece. Than just, you know, doing something wrong. Doing something wrong, you can fix it. But denying HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's really a problem. And so someone who's hiding from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, someone who's pretending like God's not there, not watching them steal, that is much, much worse. We give them a much, much greater punishment. And on like a deeper level, you know, if you look at me and you see me taking from you, then, you know, maybe you think I'm a bad dude. Maybe you're really good at Dan Lachavskos. And you're like, oh, he's having a rough time. It was a bad year, you know, COVID, and like he really needs the money. I mean, my mom's a tzaddikus, and my wife's a tzaddikus, my mom's a tzaddikus. Everyone I know are chashuv people, and so my mom used to always tell us, you know, if someone steals something from you, they probably needed it more than you did. Baruch Hashem, she's impressive, and so maybe you're all nashim tzukanios, and if someone steals from you, you're like, okay, look, all right, they needed it more than I did. But I know, if I'm stealing from you, you might think that. And so maybe, like, I don't feel that level of busha in the same way. But when I steal from a Kadosh Baruch Hu, the only person watching is God. I'm stealing from you, but you don't know what's happening. God knows me. It's not like, oh, you don't know me, you can't judge me. God knows me perfectly. God knows me better than I know me. And so God totally can judge me. And so the level of busha that someone's going to feel, should or could feel when only God is watching is actually in some ways greater. I don't think we quoted it, but the Orchos Tzaddikim says, you know, there are four there are four levels of shame. And, you know, the base level of busha that someone might feel is that, oh, I don't want people to see me doing something wrong, so I'm not going to do anything wrong. Okay, that's good. You're not going to sin, and that's great. Halavai that everyone in the world should feel that base level of busha that they don't sin. You know, the higher level is that, okay, right now, no one's watching. However, I know that at some point in time, someone's going to ask me, hey, you know, I know that this comes up from time to time with NCSY advisors. For better or worse, a lot of our NCSY advisors are growing. I worked for NCSY for 5 years. I spent a lot of time in advisor development. And sometimes you'll have advisors who are growing themselves. And, you know, and our advisors have to be all you know, fully Shomer Torah mitzvos. Most notably, it's very rare you'll have an NCSY advisor who like doesn't keep kosher, doesn't keep Shabbos. you will have NCSY advisors who struggle with Nagia. And so, you know, you have to have like a little bit of the awkward conversation. You want to make sure that they're fully committed. And as time went on, I would talk to the advisors, you know, after they've been around for a year or two, and advisors might share that, you know, they actually struggled with Nagia, but they didn't succumb. They didn't make any mistakes because they knew that, you know, on a Shabbaton 6 months from now, some teenager who's a shtickle too chutzpahdik for their own good is going to say, come on, you're not really showing Nagia. And they'll be able to say, no, of course I am. How could I not be? Because they know they're going to get the question. That's level two of Busha. Level three and four are, no, it's not about other people. It's about a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Number four really is that it is actually almost like a self-respect. It's that I'm better than this. It's the I'm a princess. You know, it's the Rabbi Twersky, and you know, you're better than that. But we didn't quote that here. But this idea, this concept of understanding that anytime someone's doing something, there's a busha of knowing that God's watching me, and I don't want to mess up. I don't, because God knows me. God knows what I can do, and so if I don't live up to that, then I'm gonna feel that busha, that dissonance. I don't want that to happen, which is why in our fourth source. But it's really Gemara and Brachos. We have it quoted from our Sefer, but it's Gemara and Brachos on Chaf Kassam and Beis. Again, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is talking to his students. This seems to be like a theme with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Which is interesting because the first 40 years of his life, he was a businessman. And then the subsequent 40 years, he committed to learning Torah exclusively and stopped working in business. And when he was 80 years old, he was the Gadol Hador, he was made the Rosh Yeshiva. And so maybe it's someone who was well attuned to the business world before he was this resounding Talmud Chacham. He's very aware of the intricacies and of people's personal lives, and maybe, you know, he saw people differently than, you know, rabbis tend to. And so he's on his deathbed, and his students are gathered around, and you can imagine, you know, what is the most important thing you want to share with your students as you're about to leave this world? What's your last lecture? And so they say, Rebbe, give us a bracha. And he says, this is in source 4, in the bold, Yihi ratzon shetehe mor shemayim aleichem kimor basav adam. Halavai, if only you guys would fear other people, would fear Kodesh Baruch Hu as much as you fear other people. That the embarrassment you feel in front of someone else should be as embarrassed as you feel in front of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And they're like, really? Like that? That's the whole bracha? The Gadol Hador's bracha? And he's like, trust me, that's pretty good. Most people, when they're sinning, they don't say, I hope God doesn't see me. They don't say, I hope God understands. They say, I hope no one can see me. Because we're physical people, and we tend to be much more concerned with what other people think than what a Kodesh Baruch Hu thinks, unfortunately. And so appreciating that and understanding that, you know, not all of us will be zoka to the bracha of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And so the Orchos Tzadikim gives us advice. You know, how do I ensure to use this mita of busha, of trying to avoid this incongruity with how I'm acting and how I'm believing? Our author, who might be male, might be female, as we questioned in our first year, says, okay, so there's a very simple answer, a very simple teretz, a path towards success. You got to get an awesome friend group. And this has been consistent. We talked about it the past 2 weeks. That you want to be surrounded with people, and that's the beauty of what we're doing here. It's not the fact that we're learning is good, but the higher level, you know, the more important level really is that there's a group of young women who are similarly motivated and committed to growth and to Torah learning. And so yashikach kokachen to all of you. And so what our author points out is that you only feel shame in front of people who you respect. If you don't respect someone, you don't care what they think about you. You know, someone who goes off in the Gemara, and Kedushin describes this, they go off to another town, to a place where no one knows them, they wear dark clothing, they go up to some like club or bar and they do bad things. There's no shame in that because they don't know anyone, they don't respect anyone, they don't care about anyone. But if we think about another mission in Pirkei Avos, how was Aharon HaKohen Makarev people? We know he was Ohev Shalom, he was Rodev Shalom, he was Ohev Esabrios Umakarvan LaTorah. So what happened? The Tana Teve Eliyahu explained to us that what happened. Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, not Tana Teve Eliyahu. The Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer elaborates on how was Aharon HaKohen Makarev people. He was a big tzaddik. Everyone knew Aharon was a big tzaddik. You could tell just by talking to him, looking at him, very similar to the way people describe Rav David Feinstein. It was like zatzal. It was so overwhelming that he was such a tzaddik. And Rav Aharon HaKohen, he would walk over to you, he'd put his arm around you, he'd talk to you, he'd speak warmly. He'd call you Rabbi so-and-so, or Tzaddik, or Tzaddikas, and he would speak to you and show you respect. People were like, I can't sin. I can't speak Lashon Hara. I can't eat that food. I can't do that. I can't watch that thing. I can't discuss this because Aaron thinks that I'm awesome. I got to live up to that. I'd be so embarrassed if Aaron knew I was doing anything other than what he seems to expect of me. And that's how he was Makara people. People got better because they felt shame in front of someone they respected. And so he was just around. He was just in front of them. And so when you have a friend group, when you have people surrounding you who have high expectations, you want to have friend groups when, you know, that are, you know, they can't be too exclusive, and you don't want there to be like standards. It's not like a pink on Thursday, on Wednesday situation. It's got to be a healthy environment. But you want to have a friend group where, yeah, of course, like, we're all going to that special kumzitz. We're all going to that cheer. Of course, we're not going to speak Lashon Hara when we're sitting, God willing, soon around the lunch table. For the 3 years I was in YU, I guess 2.5 when I was eating the calf, I remember like not worrying about Lashon Hara. It like wasn't like a thing because I knew none of my friends were going to be speaking Lashon Hara. So like I wasn't like ready to pounce and to make sure and like, you know, point out, oh, careful, don't speak Lashon Hara. Like it wasn't a concern on my radar because it wasn't what we did. My friends and I, we talked about important things. Okay, maybe not always important things, but we did speak Lashon Hara. And so if you can surround yourself with people for whom you'll be embarrassed if you don't live up to that standard, people who you're going to respect and who respect you and who are going to expect more of you, then you're doing well. Then you're great. And then you don't need, then you're not going to feel shame. You're not going to feel that inconsistency because it's sort of already there. And I guess, you know, we'll point out another NCSY advisor thing that sometimes it's, you know, it's in the context of you know, an NCSY or, you know, expecting more of you. But when I would interview NCSY advisors, they wouldn't always be as sensitive to this. But one of the reasons people become NCSY advisors is because they want to share, they want to give. Sometimes it's because they are looking to become a role model for someone. And sometimes that's actually a reason to become an advisor because you could benefit from having the external motivation. To not let someone down is actually very normal, very understandable, very healthy. Now, you know, if it's been 4 years and your whole religious confidence and lifestyle is based on the fact that you're a role model, that's unhealthy. And so I've actually advised advisors to stop being involved in NCSY when they got sort of too fixated on being the Rebbe or Mora model. But for someone, particularly in their early years, who doesn't feel so strongly grounded, someone who's not in like the most conducive environment toward growth, to have someone who looks up to you, where to be a part of a group of advisors, to create that friend group, or even just with your NCSYers, for them to have an expectation of you, that's beautiful, that's important. That's a way to make sure you're not going to feel that busha. Now we get to the next page, and this is fun. Yeah, we got time for it. Reb Moshe Feinstein, Zatzal, has a lot of awesome tshuvos. This is one tshuva that's even more of a Musar Shmuz than it is a tshuva, in part because at least my Rebbe doesn't pask in this way. For when this comes up in the context of Hilchos Nida, if you're interested, I'm happy to help figure that out, or call your local Orthodox rabbi. But Moshe Feinstein got a shaila as follows. Without getting into all of the intricate details, when a couple is in Nida, they're separating, and they don't pass things to one another. I mean, I assume that most of us are aware of this, but just to be safe. And so ordinarily you figure it out and you've got all these reminders and things. But when you're at a Shabbos table, everyone's sitting around the table and, you know, you get the big platter of chicken and, you know, when you get the big platter, you take a piece, put it on your plate, and now you're supposed to pass it. So some people are good. You're snazzy. They figure it out. Usually new couples are not as good. When you've done it long enough, you figure out, you know, how to, you know, you serve the two of you and then you pass it to the next person. It's not that hard. But Reb Moshe got a shaila that this woman was embarrassed. She didn't want to not pass things to her husband because then everyone would know that they're in Nida right now. But, you know, her kakko says she's not allowed to pass to her husband. And so Reb Moshe Feinstein basically says, like, I don't understand the question. What do you mean you're embarrassed to let people know that you're in Nida right now, that you're observing her kakkos? It's so beautiful that you're observing mitzvos. Why would you ever be embarrassed to fulfill a halacha? And he just doesn't understand the question. And he says, oh, maybe the situation is not that you're with your frum friends, where all of you, at some point over the course of this month, are going to be observing Nida and are going to have her kakos. Because everyone's doing it, and so for sure frum women around frum women are not going to be embarrassed. Maybe it's when frum women are with people who aren't keeping Hilchos Nida, who aren't so frum. And in that context, still, he says, like, I skipped most of the tshuva, but you know, in this bottom line of the Ramosha, number 5, he says, even so, Tov shalotis bayesh af lifneim b'kiyum mitzvos haTorah. Even with people who might not understand what's going on, who don't necessarily appreciate the whole Nida and Harkakos situation, you don't have to be embarrassed for doing mitzvos. That's never a reason to be embarrassed. Doing mitzvos should never cause you to feel any busha. Busha and anasias and mitzvos do not fit together. And I don't know how many times you experience this, but I've been at sporting events and realized, oh my gosh, I didn't daven mincha and I have to daven. Or you know, you'll see people like in the airport, and there are basically two people who daven in public. You know, there's the guy or the girl, but the guy who like pretends they're on a phone call. They stand like very still in a corner, and their phone's to their ear. I think apparently now it's not like this; it's a full hand. But their phone's to their ear, and they pretend like they're talking. They are talking. Halavai people should feel that way. They're talking to a Kaddish Baruch Hu. They're not on a phone call though. Rabbi Penner describes how for a period of his life he actually had to daven mincha in a phone booth, and so because he was there, he used to pick up a phone, and he said those were the best davenings of like his whole life. Because he really felt like he was talking to God. He was mamish holding a phone. Okay, so you have that guy. And then you also have the person who's like, I don't care that I'm in public. And they're like flailing their arms. And they're like clapping. And they're like screaming out words like in the middle of an airport. And on the one hand, you know, the person who's being, I guess we could call it normal. And, you know, pretending to be on the phone. It's totally understandable. And if that's how you operate, that's totally fine. But you should never really be embarrassed that you're davening. Let people see you're davening. First of all, there might be a Jew nearby who forgot to daven or isn't really interested in davening, and you're going to help them feel more confident about their tefillah. But also, people should see people davening. You should never be embarrassed that you're doing mitzvos. Never be embarrassed to make a bracha. That you should be excited to do mitzvos. And that's what that paragraph is. We have one excerpt from the 4th chapter from Azus, only because it's so short, and basically all of Busha covers Azus. But basically, what our author is pointing out is that this meat of Azus, of courage, of chutzpah, of saying, I don't care what anyone thinks, when it comes to Torah, when it comes to mitzvos, that's when you need it. Ach hamida hazos mishubakas ma'od ba'azus ha-Torah ve'avodah. When it comes to Torah learning, when it comes to doing mitzvos, that's when you need it. And then jumping down to the bottom line, third line. Basically paraphrasing Ein Habayish and Lame, that someone who's easily embarrassed is not going to learn anything. If you want to learn Torah, you got to ask questions. And this is just another push that we should have more back and forth, more questions in our shirim. We're not live tonight, which is like a little bit harder, but okay, fine. We'll let it slide tonight, although maybe at the end it'll be easier. But you can't be embarrassed to ask questions. If you don't ask a question, you will not understand it, and then you're in trouble. First of all, if someone asks a question, just on a practical level, if you're asking me a question, it's probably because I didn't explain something right, and now you're helping everyone. Or, this happens a lot, I used to give a Shabbos afternoon shiur, and now it's winter, it's too cold, but I would get questions at the end, and usually they weren't like bomb cautious, and they also weren't cautious of like, oh, I didn't understand that. Usually it was, you know, Rabbi, you asked 3 questions and you said a lot of things, but you only answered 2. You didn't answer that last question. I need someone to ask that question or we're not going to fully understand our discussion. So you got to ask questions. And for this, this actually comes up in the Shulchan Aruch. As Sif Samech, Sif Aleph says, you can never be embarrassed to do mitzvos. And if anyone's is more Hasidically inclined, or it just has the sefer, the Pizetz Rebbe in Chovas HaTalmidim in the 7th parak talks about not being embarrassed in our Torah learning. Highly recommended, we just didn't have the space or time to quote it. But there's an awesome, awesome story. I don't know if the story is true, and if the story is not true or if I'm telling it wrong, I asked Mechila from the story. I thought I heard it from a reliable source. It has been a little while, but we'll do what we can. I'm going to share my screen for a moment. It's always good to give heads up when you're going to share your screen. Share my screen for a moment just so you can appreciate who we're talking about. This is the the Soloveitchik dynasty family. You know, we're not able to appreciate and see everyone involved, but for our purposes, is that we actually don't need to worry about Arabeim, who actually fit in around here. And but we see that, you know, Ramosha Soloveitchik, son of the Beis Halevi of Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, and, you know, and one of his eldest son was Rabbi Dr. Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who we colloquially call the Rav. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, who locally in Chicago Hero, he started Brisk. Two daughters, and Dr. Shmuel, or Samuel Soloveitchik. Our story is about Dr. Samuel Soloveitchik. All right, now I'm going to unshare, because we don't need to see the screen beyond that. So this is the younger brother of the Rav and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Dr. Samuel Soloveitchik was a chemist. And he was a chemist in YU, and obviously he was a Soloveitchik, he was a genius, super impressive in so many ways. But the story that I heard is that one time in his chemistry class, you know, he was explaining an elaborate concept, he's writing all over the board, and he asked his students, he says, "You guys understand?" And they're all like, and he's like, "Really? Like, do you understand? I'll explain it differently or explain it again if you don't understand." And they all just kind of like pretend like they get it. And he's like, I feel like you don't really get it. And so now he's got to give them a teachable moment. This is a lesson he's got to teach him. And so he says, "You know, you might have noticed that both of my brothers are teaching across the street. I'm working in Yeshiva College, Yeshiva University, Dr. Soloveitchik in chemistry. Whereas, you know, my brother is the Rav and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik." I mean, they were the Rav and Rav Aaron weren't in the YU at the same time, but whatever, you get the point. And so the story he tells, and I think this was intended to praise his brother, the Rav, rather than in contrast to him. But he said when they were kids, you know, they would learn with their father, and their father would explain something to them, and say, "Do you understand?" And if you said yes, then great. And if not, he'd slap us. So you learned something. Do you understand? No, slap. Do it again. Explain the whole thing. Do you understand? No, slap. And so, and so Dr. Shmuel, after a while, learned, just say you understand and you won't get slapped. And so his father would teach him something and he'd say, "Do you understand?" And he didn't want to get slapped. So he said, "Yes, I understand." But he didn't really understand. He said, "My brother, Yosef, my brother, the Rav, he cared more about understanding than he did about getting slapped." And so his father would teach him something. And he said, "Do you understand?" He said, "No." Slap. Teach him to him again. "Do you understand?" "No." Slap. Over and over again until the Rav got it. Now, in general, in the European educational world, particularly the Soloveitchik dynasty, the assumption was someone not understanding it was not for lack of brain capacity. The Soloveitchiks were absurdly intelligent, Baruch Hashem. And so the family assumption was if you didn't get it, it's because you weren't working hard enough, not because you couldn't understand it. That's not an educational model for us today. I guess a lot of today is not about good educational models. We start with a good educational. It's okay. But this message of I care more about Torah, I care more about learning, I care more about accomplishing than I do about being embarrassed or even literally feeling the pain of a slap, not just the pain of embarrassment, that's going to take priority. That's something that's an area where busha has no place. That's an area where we want to be us. We want to be chutzpahdik. There are tons of stories, but I'm not going to tell any right now, but there are tons of stories about like the guy who's super chutzpahdik, who like asked the Rosh Hashiva a super inappropriate question, and then we get like an amazing story out of it. There's a place for that. Not everyone should be that chutzpahdik person, but if that's your netiya, then there's value to it, of pushing a little harder, of trying to understand more, of getting a little bit more of a picture into a person so that we can learn from it. That matters. That's important. Our last couple of thoughts are actually on this idea of when we talk about a chassid. What does it mean to be a chassid? So we know, you know, colloquially, a chassid is someone who's pious. That's the translation. But in this top paragraph on page 4, the Orchot Tzadikim has just an awesome insight. Because chassid in Aramaic translates into chavarta. And anyone who spends time learning Gemara knows that chavarta colloquially means clear. But literally, it means white. I mean, it's clear as white. It's as white as day, if you will. And so, literally, chassid translates into chavarta. Chassid translates into white. And so the point that the Orchot Tzadikim makes is that a chassid, a pious person, is someone who can feel shame. someone who becomes pious because they have the capacity, they have the intelligence and the self-respect and the self-goal that when there's a disconnect, when they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, they have the capacity to feel the shame, you know, the whitening of the face, as we're likely familiar. And so trying to approach shame, we can really understand that it's any time that we're going to be embarrassed. But why am I embarrassed? Because I'm not as good as I could be, or not as good as I should be, not as good as I want to be. That being said, that sometimes there's shame that it's not on us to decide whether someone should or should not feel shame. And so the last piece that we'll put here, and Orchestra Deacon always gives us tools for success. The last piece is from the 28th paragraph in Busha that says, you want to know that you're doing well, that you're a person who really is conquering the Midah of Busha and Azus. Li Olam, in the bold, Yihya Adam min ha'ne'alavim v'inan olvin, u'min ha'shomim ha'sachar pasam v'inan meshivin. Ideally, you want to be the person who is getting shamed. You don't want to shame someone else. And you want to be the kind of person who can be shamed and not respond. And there are all these stories about the koach habracha someone has when someone shames them and they don't say anything back. And part of that, you know, if I embarrass you and you don't say anything back to me, why does that give you a koach habracha? Because you did a good thing? If I give tzedakah, I don't have koach habracha. If I do other mitzvos, I don't get koach habracha. Why do I have koach habracha just because I was embarrassed and didn't respond? I think that it's not necessarily... I think we can suggest with this approach that we're taking, the reason why you're not going to be embarrassed is because... why you're going to have a koach habracha is because if you're not embarrassed, it means that you are the kind of person who's not going to feel shame. You're the kind of person who's authentic, who's consistent, who's not going to experience cognitive dissonance. If you're the kind of person that is so authentic that you're not going to feel shame when someone starts yelling at you and accusing you of things, then yeah, you can get big brachos. You're awesome. And that's what we want to try and get to. That's who we want to be. The final piece of this, we don't have sourced. The midos of Gaiva, Anava, Busha, and Azus are all fitting into one, are all lead into a midah that we're not going to discuss due to the somewhat obvious constraints, but is really the midah of Tznius. And Tznius, as some of us have learned together before, is not about the halakos of hair covering or sleeve length. Tznius, on a much larger scale, is about representing myself to the world and, you know, how much of me is internal and how much of me is external. And we're not going to delve into Tznius much further. There are actually Rabbi Eric Goldman, now Rabbi Ephraim Goldman, but Rabbi Eric Goldman, who was from the YU Kol, lives in Chicago, has an awesome shiur on YU Torah about Tznius. If you're interested, I highly recommend it. But anytime that we feel a disconnect between who we are and who we're supposed to be, we're going to feel a level of busha, a level of what we might call shame. Anytime we're recognizing that I'm actually doing well and I'm where I'm supposed to be and I push because of it and I'm more encouraged, that's what we're going to call Azus. And Azus actually has a place when it comes to our Torah learning and our mitzvah observance. We don't want to be embarrassed when those things happen. And for this week, I guess really our goal is to do our very best to make sure that our goals and who we can and who we should be align with the way we're actually presenting, the way we're actually acting. And so I guess the past hour has been a good step toward getting to that place. And Mr. Shem will continue. It's been a pleasure learning together. And I guess now, if anyone has any follow-up questions or want to correct one of the stories that I told, I'd be happy to hear. Yes, Sarah.
Yeah, I know you just mentioned it a little bit, but do you mind explaining? So Azud is like chutzpah. Is that the opposite of busha?
Yes, yes. Oh, I guess we didn't explain it well. Thank you for clarifying. Yes, busha is the... as it's described, is the holding back, is either the feeling when I'm not doing the right thing, or the thing that's going to prevent me from doing something because I know that I'm not going to feel good. Azus is, I might not feel like I should fit in. I wouldn't mention this because it got too elaborate, but there's this thing in psychology called imposter syndrome. Imposter syndrome is this thing that I probably talk about too often. It's worth looking up and reading about. It's very popular these days. It's not officially a syndrome. It's not like a DSM-5 diagnosis, but it's a thing out there where basically I feel like I'm not as good as I should be. People who are like in put in high positions, who are given lots of kavod and don't think they deserve it, Azus is saying, maybe I don't deserve, maybe I'm not on the level to be attending this year. I'm not actually so holy that I should, you know, I should be making brachos out loud, davening. I should be dressing this way, acting this way, talking this way. Maybe I'm not so holy that I should be avoiding speaking Lashon Hara. Azus is saying, I don't care. I'm going to be a little chutzpahdik. I'm going to go beyond my normal reach where I'm supposed to be to where I want to be. Now, sometimes chutzpah is bad. Sometimes you're stepping over a line. You shouldn't step over that line. But at times, chutzpah can be used for the positive. Chutzpah, it comes up more often with people who are bad sneas, people who aren't so intelligent. And so we didn't get into chutzpah quite as much because we're with holy people. All right, are we all good?
Yep.
Thank you so much for asking for the clarification.
I actually was also curious and had a question.
Okay. All right, I'm glad we clarified. So, Ziva, are we good?
Thank you so much.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Mitzvah Hashem, next week we'll be able to get together live in person. But for the time being, have a wonderful week. Stay warm, stay safe, and we'll learn together again soon.
Have a good night.
Thank you. Bye.